Ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Melanie Anderson of Bailick & Bailick on behalf of appellants. I'm joined today by my co-counsel, David Brower of Brower Piven in New York City, and Matthew Miller of Cuneo Gilbert and LaDuca in Washington, D.C. Both have been admitted pro hoc vice to this court.
Welcome to the court.
With the court's permission, Mr. Brower will be making the argument today on behalf of appellants.
All right.
Morning, Your Honors. Please, the Court. I'm David Brower. I represent the appellants, or designee appellants, on the certified question from the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York. The question today that's posed is whether plaintiffs in a double derivative action under Delaware law, who were pre-merger shareholders in the acquired company, and who are current shareholders by virtue of a stock-for-stock merger in the post-merger parent company, must also demonstrate at the time of the alleged wrongdoing at the acquired company, A, they own stock in the acquiring company, and B, the acquiring company owns stock in the acquired company. Today's appellant's answer to the question, no. Today's question brings front and center the question of what are the procedural requirements for bringing a double derivative action in a post-merger context under Delaware law. The double derivative action has been recognized in this state for many, many years. It was Justice Holland writing in Sternberg who made clear that Delaware has substantial interest in preventing the corporate form from becoming a shield for unfair business dealings, and that Delaware had a legitimate interest in providing a forum for hearing and applying Delaware law to double derivative claims related to the internal conduct of a wholly owned Delaware subsidiary. However, following the court's decision in Lewis versus Anderson, numerous Chancery Court decisions have refused to permit post-merger derivative actions brought by the owners of the pre-merger acquired company. However, in each of those actions, Ash, First Interstate, and Ward in the Chancery Court, the plaintiff did not seek nor did they allege that they were bringing a double derivative action. In each of those cases, Ash, First Interstate, and Ward, the courts made clear that the plaintiff had not brought a double derivative action and gave service to the concept that a double derivative action was indeed available as a remedy for those plaintiffs. Thus, none of the courts, including Lewis versus Anderson, which also was a simple derivative action, and which the Third Circuit in Blasband distinguished from the type of action before it, which it viewed as a derivative action, although not expressly stated as such, that no Delaware court has determined what are the requirements for a double derivative action in a post-merger situation where a shareholder of the acquired corporation seeks to continue or institute a double derivative action.
Mr. Brower, let me just make sure that I at least understand your position. As I understand it, your position is that in order to maintain a double derivative suit, the plaintiff shareholder must have been a shareholder at the time of the wrongdoing that anteceded or preceded the merger.
That's correct, Justice Jacobs.
But the acquiring corporation need not have owned stock during that time.
That's
number
correct.
One. Number two, if the plaintiff elects to proceed double derivatively after the merger in order to essentially continue with the derivative action that otherwise would be extinguished under Lewis versus Anderson, that plaintiff must make demand on the board of directors of the acquiring corporation.
That's correct as well, Justice Jacobs.
Okay. Two questions.
Yeah. With respect.
Is there any more? Did I miss anything?
Well, the shareholder also had to be a shareholder of the acquired corporation at the time the transactions took place.
Correct.
And the reason is, and let me answer the second question first. With respect to whether or not the shareholder needs to make demand, the answer is clearly yes. And that was the holding of Rails versus Blasband, by this court. And in that case, it said that Aronson doesn't apply in the situation, which was a post-merger post-merger derivative action. And it was this court found it law of the case because the Third Circuit had already found standing. So this court set forth what would be the demand requirement.
All right. So you're saying, yes, the in order to proceed double derivatively, the plaintiff shareholder must make a demand on the acquiring corporation's board of directors.
Or demonstrate demand was futile.
Or demonstrate that demand is futile. Is it not also the law that the plaintiff must make a demand on the acquired corporation's board of directors?
Or the
acquired corporation?
Well, that's a good question. Whether demand needed to be made on the acquired corporation if there was a pre-existing action is clearly yes. So if there was a pre-existing shareholder derivative action and then the merger takes place, the shareholder would have had to have made demand or demonstrated demand futility as to the acquired corporation's board of directors at the time the case is pre-merger instituted. The case law seems to say you need to make a demand on the acquired corporation's new board, that is the board of directors that now serves at the pleasure of the parent's board of directors.
You certainly can interpret the language in Rails to suggest that.
You can, but if you then follow the analysis in Rails, there's a statement in Rails, but then the analysis is of the parent's board of directors and its conflicts, not of the new subsidiary's board of directors. So there is an ambiguity in Rails as to which board of directors you look to determine demand futility.
Now, I think Rails said you look at the composition of the parent board at the time of the complaint to see whether demand is going to be excused. And then at the end of the Rails opinion, with regard to the then parent corporation making demand or alleging demand is excused on the subsidiary board, you have to look at the composition of the board, and you may even go back to Aronson in that case.
That's correct. The easier answer is if the parent's board at the time the case is instituted or at the time demand needs to be made, because where you have a post-merger situation, you may have a pause and the situation has changed. And the shareholder at that time in a reasonable time must either amend to demonstrate demand futility as to the new parent board, giving it due respect as the new board in charge, or to make the demand and either have it refused improperly or the company takes up the demand or rejects it properly. However, since the parent board now controls absolute the subsidiary board, it's simply a fiction. The idea that a shareholder needs to make a demand on the new post-merger board, because frankly, the new post-merger board does not have to listen to a shareholder of the parent ever.
New post-merger board of what corporation?
Well, in this situation, you have Bank America,
the subsidiary or the parent?
The subsidiary. Merrill Lynch is acquired by Bank America. Let's say it replaces the board 100%. You now have a new board, Bank America's board, which is the parent. You have a new board, Merrill Lynch's board, which is the subsidiary. The Merrill Lynch board sits entirely at the pleasure of the Bank America board. If a demand, therefore, anything the Bank America board tells it to do, it must do.
Regardless of any fiduciary duty obligations they have?
Yes, regardless of any fiduciary, because they can be instantly replaced if they don't follow it. They own the asset. The fact that they keep it in a corporate structure that's separate does not give them the right to not obey a 100% owner of the company, such that if a shareholder, and the more logical part...
Is that legally or practically?
It's legally, Your Honor. It's legally. If they dissented, they're replaced. That's the reality. And that's what Judge Rakoff recognized in his opinion, sending up the certified question. They can compel Merrill Lynch to bring the claim. It's an asset of Merrill Lynch that they purchased along with every other asset that they purchased, the building downtown and whatever else they purchased. The other impracticality of it is a shareholder, under Delaware law, a shareholder of a parent has no power to make a demand on the board of a subsidiary. The board of the subsidiary has an absolute right to just ignore a demand from a stranger to it, the shareholder of the parent. such that demand is always going to be futile or it's always going to be rejected properly because it's not a proper party making the demand, which would, if in fact you were to go through the formalities of a demand and a demand situation, the only demand that could ever come is a demand from Bank America, the 100% shareholder.
And that raises another question. Under your approach to the Delaware law, mm-hmm. the only shareholder who can make the demand on the board of the parent is a shareholder who owns stock in the subsidiary at the time of the alleged wrongdoing, correct?
That's correct.
Why is the universe of potential shareholder plaintiffs limited in that way?
Well, we would argue, Your Honor, and I do want to answer your last question about Bank of America having to be a shareholder to find the wrongs were committed. But in the context of a double derivative action, which is a quasi-derivative action in a sense, because it's not truly a derivative action, it recognizes a structural difference, but you need the contemporaneous ownership rule. And the reason that the requirement exists that you had to be a shareholder at the time the transactions occurred at the subsidiary is that otherwise you would be allowed to buy the claim. You could go buy some new Bank of America shares, buy the claim, and try and seek for the company to pursue it. In a double derivative action, in a post-merger situation, the fact that the shareholder needed to be a shareholder of the subsidiary at the time the transactions took place basically vindicates the requirement for both the contemporaneous and continuous ownership rules under Delaware law. It's the reason that courts like Blasband and, in fact, Chancellor Chandler, whose case we're going to talk about some more today in Sato, but in First Interstate, has a lengthy footnote agreeing with the Blasband court that the economic and legal logic is that a pre-existing shareholder who continues as a shareholder after a stock-for-stock merger, as opposed to a cash-out merger, who continues in a stock-for-stock merger, should be able to pursue the claim so far as they satisfy the demand requirement as to at least the parent's board of directors who can compel the action. And if they are unable, under the Rails analysis, to pursue the action, then that shareholder should be able to pursue it as well. With respect to whether Bank America needed to own the stock at the time, it's the misnomer of the double derivative action, and the appellees have tried to make some hay of this. A double derivative action is not two derivative lawsuits piled one on top of the other. It's a semantic difference. The concept of double derivative is structural. It recognizes that the structure of the suit, the derivative suit, is one of a double structure within the company, parent and subsidiary.
Mr. Brower, excuse me for interrupting, but in view of the time, I just have one further question. Your theory is that, that under Lewis versus Anderson, the acquiring corporation, here Bank of America, succeeded to all interest in the derivative claim. It's an asset that Bank of America can either choose to exploit by continuing the lawsuit as a direct lawsuit or not. That being the case, why couldn't any shareholder of Bank of America, whether or not that shareholder owns stock in Merrill Lynch at the time of the alleged wrongdoing, bring an action against the board of Bank of America for, in a sense, mismanaging the asset?
The reason would be, first of all, it would be exactly what happened in Lewis versus Anderson, which this court, unless it's prepared to overrule it, is exactly what happened. It was the so-called single derivative or simple derivative action. It was not brought as a double derivative. And the reason, Your Honor, that there's a different rule, that is you needed to be a stockholder at the time of the wrong, is because it's what allows the interest in the asset that resides with the shares and resides with the corporation to continue from the time the wrong was committed to the time the suit is ended, assuming the shareholder holds to the end. And it's a different extra requirement, so to speak, in order to give standing and permit standing where the other requirements are otherwise met. And therefore, it takes it out of the problem that was in Anderson. The problem was the theory that when these shares were exchanged, and it was the Conoco-DuPont merger, of course, when the shares were exchanged, the claim was cut off. Well, in fact, what happens is the standing to pursue the claim was cut off in the simple derivative action. The interest, which is what Delaware law has looked to with respect to why there is a contemporaneous and continuous ownership rule, the interest in the asset, that is the cause of action, runs with the asset itself. That asset is never out of the hands of the shareholder in a stock-for-stock merger. What happens in a stock-for-stock merger is no different than what happens in any stock-for-stock merger this Court's held under Time Warner and under Paramount. There's no change of control of the underlying assets. What happens is you exchange your share in your assets for a piece of paper representing your assets as well as the additional assets. And you may have a diluted interest in your own assets, but at the same time, you've received some other assets in the greater whole. And by requiring a shareholder have been a shareholder at the time the wrongs were committed at the subsidiary, what you have done is you have guaranteed a continuous, unbroken string of interest in the asset that suffices for the purpose and the policies behind the contemporaneous ownership rule.
But let's assume that this was not a double derivative suit. Let's assume the Bank of America board was just sitting around and they said, you know what, we should bring a derivative suit against the subsidiary. They just decide this on their own. And why should they or should they not be permitted to do that?
Okay. They can, which is the answer to Justice Jacobs' first question in this colloquy. Bank of America owns this claim. Whether directly or because it has complete power over the subsidiary, Bank of America, any time it wants, can go after Mr. O'Neill and the other former directors and officers of Merrill Lynch so far as the statute of limitations is still alive. That is the reason it's called a double derivative, and it's not two lawsuits on each other. It's not Bank of America making demand on Merrill to go seek the claim. Bank of America has the power to compel that claim to be brought anytime it wants, just like if it was having a fight with its landlord on its World Financial Center building. Bank of America is going to say whether or not they're going to have a litigation with that landlord over the real estate.
But in reality, the suit has to be initiated in the name of the subsidiary.
The suit needs to be initiated both in the name of the subsidiary and the parent. I believe Your Honor held in Sternberg that the parent, acquiring parent corporation, must be a nominal defendant in the case, as well as the subsidiary, in order to have a double derivative action. And the reasoning behind that is because the parent is the ultimate beneficiary and then ultimately the shareholders of the parent, who are now the former shareholders of the subsidiary. The reason the company, which is the answer to your Justice Jacobs question, which is why the company doesn't need to have had the claim that owned Maryland stock at the time the wrongs were committed, they inherited the claim along with every other asset of the company. They have a claim against their landlord, they inherited it. Merrill Lynch's landlord, they inherited that. If they have any other kinds of claims, as well as all the other assets. So it makes no sense if Bank America owns the shares. Since it's not bringing a derivative action, what is happening is a shareholder of Bank America who was a shareholder of Merrill Lynch is now recognizing through the demand requirement the interposition of the parent board of directors who is entitled to the respect of either getting demand or having demand demonstrated as futile towards them. I'm going to save my 6 minutes, unless there are other questions, Ron.
May it please the Court, it's Paul Lockwood. I'm here on behalf of the nominal defendants, Bank of America Corporation and Merrill Lynch & Co., Inc., and I'm also speaking here today for the other appellees. I have just want to sketch out four primary responses to the plaintiff's arguments that were made thus far. The first is that the position that they're taking on this appeal is inconsistent with the core holding of Lewis versus Anderson. The second is that Chancellor Chandler's interpretation of Section 327 in Cito versus McCall is consistent with the language of Section 327. Third, that the plaintiff's loss of standing to pursue these claims will not cause a wrong without a remedy. And the fourth is that the continuity of interest theory that the plaintiffs relies upon is not only inconsistent with Lewis versus Anderson, it's really the exact theory the Third Circuit took up in Blasband versus Rails, a theory that has been rejected by this court, rejected by the Court of Chancery, rejected by the District of Delaware that is required to follow the Third Circuit in normal circumstances. To start with Lewis versus Anderson, which is the seminal decision on Section 327 in the merger context, that decision endorsed a long line of cases from the Court of Chancery that goes back to 1964 that have consistently held, for this is now half a century of case law in Delaware, that upon a merger, standing to pursue a derivative claim by the former shareholders is, in the words of this court, destroyed. The court also uses the language that the loss of stock ownership eliminates standing to pursue the derivative claims. Now, the claim doesn't go away. The claim is not destroyed or eliminated. It's the plaintiff's standing that goes away, and that's what we're here on. And that standing is transferred to the surviving corporation and its new parent, which is its sole shareholder. And as a result, the former status as old shareholders of the old company no longer has any power. It doesn't grant standing at all. And plaintiff's theory here is premised. The linchpin of their standing theory is the ghost of their old status as Merrill Lynch shareholders. And that status does not give them standing. And the plaintiff's proposal for Section 327 is that it would require share ownership in the old company prior to the merger, share ownership in the new company after the merger. And that position conflicts with Lewis versus Anderson, which says that the old status as an old shareholder, any standing based on that status has been eliminated as a result of the merger. So if the plaintiffs are going to have standing here today to pursue a lawsuit, they got to stand on their own 2 feet as Bank of America shareholders.
Well, your position, however, is that there would be standing if, say, Bank America had shares, owned shares in Merrill Lynch at the time of the alleged wrongdoing. But that creates a self-contradictory, impossible situation, doesn't it? Because on the one hand, under the statute, Section 259, in its capacity as acquirer, Bank of America would inherit the claim. But under Lewis versus Anderson, its standing to bring a derivative claim, had it chosen to do that, would be eliminated.
Well, the reason for that, though, is that Bank of America, if it's going to pursue the claim itself, is not going to pursue it derivatively. Bank of America is going to ask the Merrill Lynch Board of Directors to pursue the claim, and the Merrill Lynch Board of Directors would take up the claim in the name of Merrill Lynch, not derivatively in the name of Bank of America. I can give you a real-world example with a case that I know Your Honor was long familiar with, which was the case of Telzon versus Meyerson. And that was a long-pending derivative suit. And upon the merger of Telzon with another company.
The answer to my question is yes, the standing of the original shareholder plaintiff to bring the suit derivatively is extinguished.
Yes.
But the standing, and that would certainly also be the case for Bank of America had it been the plaintiff.
Yes.
But Bank of America wearing a different hat as acquirer can now, after the merger, bring the action directly. And that's your reconciliation of the statute and Lewis versus Anderson.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And why are you characterizing the Bank of America action as a direct action?
Well, Bank of America wouldn't bring the action in its own name. I mean, if Bank of America was going to sue, Bank of America wanted Merrill Lynch to sue the people represented by the folks behind me. The Bank of America board would decide, we think this makes sense to bring this lawsuit. As a formal matter, they've got to get Merrill Lynch to be the plaintiff. They can't sue in their own name because it's a subsidiary claim. It would be dismissed for not having the correct party in interest as the plaintiff. So they have to have Merrill Lynch bring the claim. And what they would do is they would tell the Merrill Lynch board, we think it's a really good idea to bring this claim. And then they'd have to persuade the Merrill Lynch board to bring the claim. I think Mr. Brower is right as a practical matter that matter of persuasion wouldn't be difficult, but it would be ultimately Merrill Lynch's decision to bring the claim.
And but Merrill Lynch, Bank of America would have two choices. If the Merrill Lynch board will say, notwithstanding the fact they were elected by Bank of America, said we're not bringing the claim, and then Bank of America would have two choices, bring a derivative claim or elect a new board.
Yes, that is true. And I think the easier move would be to elect a new board, but they can certainly bring a derivative claim under those circumstances as well. But in each case, it respects the corporate form.
But if it brought a derivative claim, it would be bringing a claim for conduct that occurred when it was not a shareholder of the subsidiary, wouldn't it?
Correct, and that's why the plaintiffs don't have standing here when they stand in the shoes of Bank of America.
Well, but my question is, can Bank of America bring the claim derivatively? And in answer to my prior question, you said yes, but now you're saying they have a problem.
Yes, no, let me clarify. Bank of America provided that they could satisfy the derivative requirements, could pursue it either way. But here, because Bank of America is not a shareholder of Merrill Lynch pre-merger, it can't pursue the claim derivatively because it's got to satisfy Section 327 like any other shareholder. It doesn't have, there isn't some special majority owner exception to Section 327.
So it brings the claim directly.
They'd have to bring the claim directly by having Merrill Lynch bring it.
But under your theory, if the board, let's assume improperly or wrongly, decides not to pursue the claim directly, then any shareholder of Bank of America would be entitled to, I mean, subject to either making demand or showing that demand is futile, bring that claim derivatively. Isn't that correct?
Yes, and double they could actually bring it double derivatively as well. They could sue on behalf of Bank of America and Merrill Lynch against the Merrill Lynch board that's standing against its parents' wishes.
So how does that scenario differ at all from what the other side is arguing?
Well, what makes it different is it's a completely different case. It's going to have different defendants. The defendants are going to be either the Merrill Lynch Board of Directors or the Bank of America Board of Directors. It's not going to be the former officers and directors of Merrill Lynch. The facts at issue in that case are not going to be the underlying facts of the claim. It's going to be the decision made by the board to pursue the lawsuit or not to pursue the lawsuit, the legal advice they received regarding that, the analysis of the claims that they did.
Let me make sure I understand that. You're saying that the only double derivative lawsuit that could be brought would be against the board of the acquiring company, Bank of America, for wrongfully failing to pursue a lawsuit against the former directors of Merrill Lynch, who would not be parties to that lawsuit? That is, to the new lawsuit?
Correct. Except it could be the new board of Merrill Lynch as
well. If liability is established, I guess any damage award would have to be determined on the basis of what a hypothetical lawsuit, what damages a hypothetical lawsuit against the former board of Merrill Lynch would have generated? Is that what you're saying?
It would be much like any claim challenging a business decision of a board of directors. The analysis would be, what was the decision you made? Was it such a bad decision that it hurt the company because you gave up a claim that was worth a certain amount of money and you should have pursued it and you didn't?
But doesn't the scenario that you've just described, isn't that really a direct lawsuit and not a double derivative lawsuit?
No.
I mean, how could you have a double derivative lawsuit if the former directors of Merrill Lynch pre-merger are not parties?
It would be a lawsuit against the post-merger directors of Merrill Lynch.
Who may have done nothing wrong.
Well, and they may have done nothing wrong, so therefore
they may be replacements of the old board. Why would anybody want to sue them?
Well, because it would be their decision, Your Honor. The decision that would be at issue in the lawsuit that can be brought is the decision not to sue, the decision to not to pursue the claim.
Yes.
So if that is the decision that is issue, that decision is going to be made by the Bank of America board and the Merrill Lynch board. The shareholder would go to Bank of America's board and ask them to sue. Bank of America board would turn them down. The shareholder would go to the Merrill Lynch board, ask them to sue. That board would turn them down. It's in Cito versus McCall, it's footnote 80 of Chancellor Chandler's opinion. He notes that that's the remedy available to the plaintiffs, which is to sue the board post-merger for a failure to sue. And in those circumstances, Section 327 isn't a bar at the Bank of America level, nor at the Merrill Lynch level. And it is also the case in those circumstances that the status of a former Merrill Lynch shareholder doesn't matter. It's who was a shareholder of Bank of America at the time that the decision was made regarding that litigation, regarding whether or not to pursue that litigation. Now,
excuse me, I'm very confused now. Are you saying that that is a derivative suit? That a stockholder of Bank of America who wants to sue the Bank of America board and perhaps the Merrill Lynch board, too, for failing to pursue a claim, that would be a derivative action?
Yeah, it would be a derivative action because it's an asset of the corporation that the directors who owe fiduciary duties to the corporation and its shareholders have allegedly mismanaged in breach of their duties. So the claim would be it would be no different than any than if you think about it, a decision to pursue a transaction. It's not make it a lawsuit. The kind of situations that this court faces all the time. A decision to purchase or sell an asset is made, and the shareholders don't like that decision because it ended up being a very bad decision, and they bring a lawsuit against the board of directors saying you made a bad judgment in buying or selling this lawsuit. And of course they usually will have to point out conflicts of interest or some other grounds for getting around the business judgment rule. But that type of decision is no different than a decision to pursue or not to pursue a lawsuit. And this court noted that in White versus Panic, where the court held that a decision to pursue a lawsuit or not to pursue a lawsuit is no different than any other business decision, and that it is a decision protected by the business judgment rule in most circumstances. But like any other decision protected by the business judgment rule, there's a potential for finding that the directors did not act appropriately. But
we're talking about two different things, and we discussed this in Spiegel and Buntrock. If you decide that you demand is excused, then you have to demonstrate why it's excused. But if you make a demand, the decision to pursue or not pursue the lawsuit is looked at under the business judgment rule.
Well, this is similar to a demand, but it's not exactly the same, because it's the decision to pursue the litigation that is the challenge decision, as opposed to just being the threshold decision. In a typical demand situation, the threshold decision is as to whether to pursue the underlying claims, or whether the plaintiff can pursue the underlying claims, is whether a demand was properly refused. Here, the lawsuit could be brought. For example, in Cito versus McCall, no demand was made there, and the plaintiffs brought suit and said the inaction of the directors was a breach of fiduciary duty because they were sitting on valuable claims, and they brought suit on that basis. And Chancellor Chandler dismissed that claim at the time as unripe because he held that the statute of limitations had not expired, that the board had reasons for not moving on the claims immediately, and they had tolling agreements in place with certain of the defendants. So these are just business judgments that directors are allowed to make. And under our law, of course, shareholders can challenge business judgments in the courts if they believe that they're egregious judgments that are breaches of fiduciary duties.
But doesn't the board have to act affirmatively to do that? You seem to be glossing over whether the board made a decision not to bring a suit. It's one thing just to have time go by and there's this good lawsuit that they're not pursuing, but they're not saying yes or no. They're simply not pursuing it, and time is going by. It's another thing to have board minutes reflect, we've looked at this, we've decided not to do it. So what do you do in the situation where it's simply inaction?
Well, I think the inaction, you can, just as if there was some opportunity that was lost, I think what Chancellor Chandler said in the inaction circumstances is that you wait until the statute of limitations expires, and then you sue for losing the asset. But in this case here, we don't have that circumstance because one of the plaintiffs, Lambrecht, actually made a demand.
So then we're in a situation we see in professional malpractice. If you've missed the statute of limitations, your professional malpractice action has two parts, one of which is the measure of damages, which depends on the value of the suit that was never made. Is that right?
Yes. I think that's how you would pursue that action. And that action is consistent with Section 327 and does no harm to it. The plaintiff's proposal does.
Let me just interrupt at this point because I'm still not clear about how your model works. It's not unknown in the history of corporate litigation that when the composition of a board changes as the result of, let's say, a takeover, that the new board sues the old board or causes the corporation to sue the old board for breach of fiduciary duty. In this case, you could at least apply that same reasoning hypothetically. That is, Bank of America acquires Merrill Lynch, Bank of America replaces the board, and then causes the new board to cause the corporation that is the subsidiary to bring suit against the old board. That's legally possible, is it not?
Yeah, and that's one of the
options.
Yes.
All right. And if the board of Bank of America chooses for whatever reason not to do that, and a shareholder believes that is a shareholder of Bank of America, who was a shareholder of Merrill Lynch at the relevant time, believes that that's a wrongful decision, then that shareholder should be able to bring a double derivative action.
Well, based on the decision not to sue, they can bring a single derivative action against the Bank of America board, a double derivative action against the post-merger Merrill board that did not
no,
sue.
No, they could bring a double derivative action against the pre-merger Merrill board, assuming that they can show that a demand on both post-merger boards would be futile, correct?
No, I disagree.
You can't do that?
No, because of Section 327. I mean, that's Cito versus McCall. And the reason why you can't do that is because unless you can show that
Bank of America could do it, but not a shareholder of Bank of America who can demonstrate to a court that the Bank of America's post-merger decision not to prosecute that claim is wrongful?
Correct. And the reason why is because if Merrill Lynch acts through its board of directors pursuant to 141A, Section 327 does not apply. Section 327 doesn't apply to a board of directors decision to pursue a lawsuit. It only applies to a shareholder pursuing a derivative suit. And the loss of standing here comes from that statute, Section 327. So if Merrill Lynch, pursuant to a request of its parent, Bank of America, is taking action, then it's taking action pursuant to 141A, and all of the protections against derivative litigation that our law has created fall away, because we're not concerned about it.
You agree that post-merger shareholder of Bank of America that owned stock in Merrill Lynch at the time of the alleged first wrongdoing could bring suit against the Bank of America directors and the new Merrill Lynch directors. And if that suit is shown to have merit, then like the malpractice action that Justice Holland was talking about, the damages would be determined on the basis of a hypothetical lawsuit that should have been brought against the original Merrill Lynch directors but was not. Is that right?
I do agree with that, yes.
All right. But that's as far as the law allows that form of action to go. It's legally impossible to actually join the pre-merger Merrill Lynch directors and have a real suit rather than a hypothetical suit.
For the most part, consistent with Section 327, the plaintiffs have described it as this.
Is there any what in the text of 327 precludes that result? I understand that the McCall decision interprets it otherwise, but what in the text of 327 precludes that result?
The text of 327 requires in a derivative action brought by any stockholder of a corporation that it shall be averred that the plaintiff was a stockholder of the corporation at the time of the wrong. So if a post-merger double derivative action is brought on behalf of Bank of America and Merrill Lynch, Bank of America shareholder must allege that he or she was a shareholder of Bank of America at the time of the wrong. And here the plaintiffs weren't. At that time, they were Merrill Lynch shareholders. And in the second layer of the derivative action, Bank of America acting derivatively on behalf of Merrill Lynch, Bank of America must be a shareholder of Merrill Lynch at the time of the wrong. That's how Section 327 works in its text.
So then, going back to my earlier question, the answer has to be different. We talked about Bank of America having two options, either electing a new board or bringing a derivative suit. But based on what you just said, since Bank of America was not a shareholder at the time of the wrongdoing, bringing a derivative suit would not be an option.
Yes, it would not be an option for Bank of America if it does not own shares at the time of the wrong. So under the facts here, Bank of America would be precluded from pursuing the suit derivatively and would have to ask Merrill Lynch to act directly and replace the board if they do not.
And just to be sure I'm clear on this, in your view, if the stockholder had the good fortune, if you will, of being both a stockholder of Merrill Lynch and Bank of America at the time of the Merrill Lynch alleged wrongs, that stockholder today could bring the double derivative suit, correct?
Well, only if Bank of America was also a shareholder of Merrill Lynch. And the reason why is because of the two layers of a double derivative suit. And we put this out in our brief as to what a double derivative suit really is. Is it a veil-piercing mechanism, or is it two derivative suits stacked on top of each other? And I think the explanation in our law, if you go through the cases, is it's two lawsuits stacked on top of each other. And the reason...
Okay, so wait a second. So you're saying that both the stockholder who wants to bring this action has to have owned both companies' stock, and the parent, in this case Bank of America, had to have owned Merrill Lynch stock. But if both groups had owned both companies' stock at the time of the wrong, then this stockholder could bring a double derivative suit? Is that your view?
Yes, although, in fact, the Merrill Lynch ownership is irrelevant by the parent company holder, because at that point they're acting as a shareholder of Bank of America, so they have to show they own Bank of America stock at the time of the wrong. That complies with Section 327's requirement that the stockholder...
I thought you just finished saying that Bank of America had to also own Merrill Lynch stock.
Yes, both of those requirements. Bank of America has to own Merrill Lynch stock, and the plaintiff stockholder has to own Bank of America stock.
You could help me by articulating how 327 drives that result.
Think of the classic double derivative suit, the Sternberg versus O'Neill double derivative suit. And if you think of it from that perspective, I think it makes more sense. In the typical operating company subsidiary circumstances, you'll have the holding company and its shareholders at the top, the operating company below. The holding company shareholders don't own any shares of the parent company, of the operating company. Wrong is done down at this level, right? At the time of the wrong, under Section 327, the plaintiff would have to show that they're a stockholder of the parent company, and the parent company is a stockholder of the subsidiary at the time of the wrong, and therefore there's a link from the shareholder down to the wrong, timing-wise and through stock ownership. It makes sense in those circumstances. In the post-merger circumstances, it doesn't work, but that's because Lewis versus Anderson cuts off standing based on the old shareholder situation. And what the plaintiffs are doing here is that they're taking this double derivative case that's developed for that classic structure and trying to use it as an escape valve for Lewis versus Anderson, which it's not. The escape valve for Lewis versus Anderson is the post-merger suit for failure to sue. It is not this double derivative claim. And the reason why Section 327 works that way is because Section 327 should be applied at both the parent company level and the subsidiary level, as in any other circumstance. There's no reason to disregard Section 327 at the subsidiary level just because it's a subsidiary. It's an independent corporation with equal status to the parent company. And as this court noted in Rails versus Blasband, there's a requirement of a demand on both boards. And the reason for that requirement of a demand on both boards is because the court is recognizing that the dignity and the separate status of the subsidiary has to be recognized.
But the real issue here is standing. And in Rails, we put in a footnote that said that standing had already been determined by the Third Circuit, and we weren't saying we agreed or we disagreed with the Third Circuit's ruling on standing. Is that right?
That's correct. And what Rails doesn't answer the standing question, but the approach in Rails and the approach in Lewis is consistent with treating the separate dignity of the corporations in all respect. Same as Sternberg versus O'Neill. Sternberg versus O'Neill had an Ohio parent company and a Delaware subsidiary, and the court said that the Internal Affairs Doctrine would apply, and for the Ohio company, Ohio law would apply, and for the Delaware company, Delaware law would apply. And
let me ask you one more question. You began your remarks with 4 points. And one of them was, if we rule in your favor, it's not like this alleged wrong won't be redressed. So just tell us clearly what's the remedy here, and notwithstanding the fact that we rule in your favor.
Okay. Lewis versus Anderson addressed this question and said that the claim doesn't go away. The claim gets transferred to the new company and the new fiduciaries who are responsible for managing the claim. So in these circumstances, there are fiduciaries at Bank of America, there are fiduciaries at Merrill Lynch who are responsible for managing this claim and who will bring it if it serves the best interest of the company. If they don't, the plaintiffs have a remedy just like any other situation where fiduciaries have not acted consistent with their fiduciary duties, which is they could sue them for breach of fiduciary duty.
So that was your answer to my inaction question. If we simply have inaction and time goes by and the statute of limitation runs, then you have a cause of action because the people didn't discharge their fiduciary duties.
Exactly, and Chancellor Chandler states that in Cito versus McCall. In that case, the court dismissed the claim for lack of ripeness because the statute of limitations had not yet expired, but recognized that that was a claim that existed and was the outlet that those plaintiffs had to redress their wrongs. And you can't assume that it's a breach of fiduciary duty. What's gone on here is the plaintiffs want to pursue their old case as if it's unbroken, but the case has been transformed by the merger. They don't have standing to pursue that case anymore. If they want to go forward, they have to have a different case, which is based on essentially a different framework.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I thought it was very helpful that Mr. Lockwood told us that it doesn't matter if you were ever a Merrill Lynch shareholder at the time of the wrongs. My concern now is how 327 is ever satisfied, since it clearly requires that you had been a shareholder at the time the transactions took place, which were many years before the B of A Merrill Lynch merger was a glint in any of these people's eye. Let me quickly respond to the questions you raised. With respect to the idea that you need to sue the Bank America board for failing to bring the claim, that issue was the argument made in Blasband, which I know is not the most popular case in the Chancery courts, but what Circuit Judge Greenberg said was that argument means is two wrongs must occur. In order to find demand futility as to the B of A board, as to the Merrill board at the time, or the new Merrill board, under Rails, you need only find that that board has a reason that it cannot independently adjudicate whether or not to bring the claim. And therefore, the shareholder would be able to pursue the claim because they'd be disabled under Aronson and Rails. However, what they're now arguing is you need a second wrong by the Bank America board in order for this claim ever to be pursued. And that's not the test. The requirement that the successor board actually commit a breach of fiduciary duty is not the requirement for demand or the requirement for standing. That's, however, what they're saying, and in Blanspan, they called it the two wrong theory, which is not required for a double derivative action. The board of Bank America didn't have to do anything wrong. And in Rails, you recognize no business decision had to be made by the board of directors to have demand futility. That demand futility could be found simply because the board was unable to pursue the claim because of some pre-merger or post-merger reasons of their own, which is exactly what's been alleged here with respect to demand futility. Second, there is nothing in the discussion in Sato about 327. Sato entirely relies, in part of it, on Lewis versus Anderson. Then the requirements that the Bank America, that the acquiring company be a shareholder at the time of the wrongs, and that the shareholder plaintiff also have been a shareholder of both companies at the time of the wrong, are in footnotes in Sato with no explanation or citation to what they are. I would suggest the court look more to Chancellor Chandler's decision in First Interstate, where he has a lengthy footnote explaining why he would follow Blasband, but that he believes Lewis versus Anderson doesn't permit him to do so, and therefore asks this court to resolve the ambiguity, which he thinks makes no sense, which was echoed by Judge Rakoff in his certification opinion, where he says this makes no sense, those two additional requirements. Because, as Justice Berger said, then it's just happenstance. It's serendipity that there may be a shareholder who can actually pursue these claims that has nothing to do with the logic or the policy of Delaware law. In addition, the argument that they have a remedy. This court in Ward said no. This court in Ward said in this fact pattern, the plaintiff did have a remedy, the double derivative action. That's exactly what these plaintiffs have done. That was the argument made in Ward, and the answer in Ward to there is a remedy is there isn't a direct derivative action by the plaintiffs, the acquiring company shareholder who becomes a shareholder of the parent. There's a double derivative remedy, and the plaintiff in Ward simply didn't assert a double derivative claim. He didn't label it as such. In First Interstate, Chancellor Chandler points out, the plaintiff never asserted a double derivative claim and therefore wasn't pursuing that form of action. Therefore, it's wholly consistent, and this court's decision in Bradley versus First Interstate is wholly consistent because you have not had a case where someone has come before this court in a post-merger situation where they have in fact asserted a double derivative case, have asserted demand futility as to all three boards, that is the parent board, the new subsidiary board, as well as the pre-existing board. What you're hearing from the defendants today is a heads we win, tails you lose scenario. That is so clearly the kind of thing that Justice Holland wrote about in preventing misdeeds by the corporate structure that Delaware won't allow. That's exactly what they want. A merger becomes the ultimate indemnification for wrongdoing defendants. Once the merger takes place, the individual defendants at the subsidiary, who are no longer the officers and directors, who have left, scattered out the back door, are free as a bird. Because while the board of Bank of America can't force the Merrill Lynch board to do this, they have to make demand on them. And Bank of America had to be a pre-existing shareholder anyway, because that was the time that the transactions took place. Because in answer to your question, Justice Holland, he got around it. Their argument is clear. They argue, we believe they're wrong, but those aren't the issues today. Bank of America was not a shareholder of Merrill Lynch at the time the transactions issue took place. They could not bring a derivative action. This is a double derivative action. Therefore,
why isn't all of this a matter for the General Assembly to remedy, given the restrictions that 327 imposes on derivative action?
Well, because the derivative action is one in equity and always has been. And the courts have repeatedly found that the double derivative action is a form of action that exists in this circumstance. And the answer is the legislature did not make the decision in Lewis versus Anderson. This court did. And Lewis versus Anderson doesn't necessarily cover every situation. It was the direct derivative action. It did not deal with a double derivative action. And that's the way the Third Circuit distinguished it. And, in fact, it doesn't deal with a double derivative action. It's an action where the shareholder of the subsidiary continued to claim standing based solely on ownership of the subsidiary stock, never claiming that they, because they were DuPont shareholders and of course, never made demand on the DuPont board or asserted demand futility as to the DuPont board, tried to continue the action solely based on the arguments they had made with respect to the old Conoco board. The answer is it's a question of equity. Right now, based on their argument as to what are the requirements, there is no remedy. And equity will not allow there to be no remedy. And what they've told you is B of A, who's a stranger to the events, and they've thrown 327 out the window in their own argument because they said that it doesn't matter if shareholders of Merrill Lynch were shareholders of the time because it doesn't matter. It's only where B of A is, and whether B of A could bring a derivative case at the time, there's no support for that in the law, for those additional requirements.
Well, does the phrase in any derivative action include double derivatives?
I would argue no. I would argue this is a quasi-creature of equity. It's not quite a derivative action. It's a separate action recognized in equity. It's a separate action that this court has repeatedly recognized. And what I would suggest, Your Honor, is, again, the term double derivative is not literally two lawsuits on top of each other. Bank America's right to bring a derivative case brought by a shareholder could bring a derivative case against Bank America.
Well, I'd like you to respond to my earlier question to Mr. Lockwood, where we assume hypothetically this is not a double derivative suit. It's simply today the Bank of America board sitting around saying, you know, we really should bring a suit. Can they do that? Or is it incumbent upon them to try to get the Merrill Lynch board to do it?
Can Bank of America compel the bringing of the action? Yes.
Could they do that in a derivative suit?
They wouldn't ever do it in it. Could they compel it in a derivative suit? No, they couldn't compel it in a derivative suit because I think Mr. Lockwood's exactly right. If Bank America had to bring a derivative suit as a shareholder of Merrill Lynch, it was not a shareholder at the time the wrongs were committed. So now the wrongs are, you're not going after the wrongdoers anymore. You're not going after Mr. O'Neill and Mr. Thain anymore at Merrill Lynch. Now you're going to go after whoever the directors of Merrill Lynch are and require Bank America to sue their own appointees.
No, I know. So let's come back now to this double derivative suit.
Okay.
What is it that you're asking in the double derivative suit? Because assume you have standing for phase one, mm-hmm. which is you're now a Bank of America shareholder, you were a Merrill Lynch shareholder at the time of the wrongdoing, you're bringing a derivative suit against Bank of America to do something. Do you want Bank of America to bring a derivative suit against Merrill Lynch, or do you want them to somehow cause a direct suit to be brought?
Well, what if you're asking if I bring a suit, in order to bring a suit and meet the procedural requirements of bringing that suit as a simple derivative, as a current B of A shareholder, bringing a simple derivative suit against Bank America.
To do what? What do you want?
I want them to recover on the claim. I want them to recover money from Mr. Thain and Mr. O'Neill for the damage done to the company with respect to the CDOs that were purchased 5 or 10 years ago and with respect to the bonuses that were paid in connection with the merger before the merger was closed.
So, but you seem to agree that if you can bring this derivative suit against Bank of America, the next step is going to be for the Bank of America to cause a direct suit to be brought.
Well, I think Bank of America is not going to bring that direct suit because
have to cause it to be brought by the current Merrill Lynch board.
Right. You're asking if I made a demand, not brought a suit, I think.
Well, I'm trying to find out if you get beyond phase one, what's going to happen in phase two.
Oh, in phase two, very simply. The shareholder plaintiff, I'll give you what Ms. Loveman did. Ms. Loveman brought a suit. She named Merrill Lynch and Bank America as required by Sternberg as nominal defendants. She sued all of the people who did the wrongdoing, she alleges, at Merrill Lynch over the period of years before the merger. She did not name the Bank America directors who she doesn't allege in this complaint made any business decisions that are subject to review. And she's pursuing those claims because under her demand futility allegations, demand on the Bank America board is futile because she's alleged facts to show that they are unable to properly consider a demand in this situation.
So it's a
single
wrongdoing by the original Merrill Lynch board, coupled with the disablement of the board of directors of the acquired company, Bank of America, to prosecute that suit.
Correctly. Exactly the facts of Rails versus Blasband, where the Denihar board was the board that this court looked at in determining whether they were disabled from pursuing the suit on behalf of the parent, on behalf of the subsidiary. There's no difference here. What they're telling you is it's a get-out-of-jail-free card because, again, there's no remedy if you start doing this kind of formulistic. If B of A can bring it as a shareholder, it would need to make a demand or show demand futility. Then it would have to bring the suit, and if it didn't own Merrill Lynch stock at the time of the wrong, it falls out of 327.
Counsel, we're way out of time.
I know you.
We've talked a lot about equity. We have to think about the equity to the other people appearing later in the day.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for a very interesting argument. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.